Okay, I'm going to call House Finance to order. The time is 1:41 p.m. on Tuesday, May 6th, 2025. And present today, we've got Representative Allard, Representative Hannon, Representative Bynum, Co-Chair Josephson, Representative Galvin, Representative Tomaszewski, Representative Stapp, myself, Co-Chair Foster. Just a reminder, folks can mute their cell phones. We just have one bill before us today, and that's House Bill 99. That's the Money Transmission Virtual Currency Bill. We just have an introductory hearing. We'll hear from the sponsor. We'll take invited testimony. We'll review the fiscal note, take public testimony, and then maybe if we could get everything on the table, and then we'll go to questions. Also have with us Representative Co-Chair Shragi. So again, if we could kind of just get everything on the table, and then we'll take questions. If I can invite up Representative Fields as well as his staff, Mr. Evan Anderson, if you could put yourselves on the record. Available for questions, just so folks know, are Rob Schmidt, Director of Division of Banking, Tracy Reno, Chief Examinations for Division of Banking, Don Hanisch, Division Operations Manager, Division of Banking. So with that, Representative Fields, thanks for being here today.
Thank you. Zach Fields, House District 17.
Evan Anderson, staff to Rep. Fields.
Thank you for the opportunity to present House Bill 99. This is a money transmission modernization bill. We started to hear this bill last year when it was carried by the department. I thought it made a lot of sense to combat money laundering and provide important protections for Alaskans who may be targeted by increasingly sophisticated and numerous scams. So when the department asked me to carry the bill this year, I said yes. I think I'm going to leave the high-level summary at that because it does have a long sectional if you want to hear it.
Okay. Let's see. Do we have – so you've got the sectional. Is there – maybe if you could – were you going to walk us through, I guess, the guts first before we get into the sectional or – okay. If you could introduce yourself.
Sure. Evan Anderson, staff to Representative Zach Fields. I'll walk through a narrative of the sectional analysis that's in members' packets, and if there's any sections that we want to dive deeper into, I'm happy to go a little deeper as well. This proposed bill is not a simple repeal and reenactment of AS06.55. Instead, it's a line-by-line overhaul of the Act, carefully considering a national model law and selectively adopting and revising the statutes. The bill repeals the currency exchange license and includes that activity in the definition of money transmission, so only one license type will be required in AS06.55 going forward. Sections 1 through 6 are related to licensing. They add a section of uncodified law explaining the purpose of the bill and amending language related to licensing application and license renewal requirements. They also add criminal background check report requirements for individuals who are senior management and control the company. They also allow the department to utilize the Nationwide Multi-State Licensing System, or NMLS, for all aspects of licensing. Section 7 amends AS06.55 to add new sections to Article 1A concerning virtual currency derived from the model law. Virtual currency business activity replaces currency exchange licenses as the heading for Article 1A. These sections provide the details of what is considered and what is not considered licensed activity for companies engaged in virtual currency business activity. Section 8 repeals and reenacts AS06.55.301, creating a requirement that a licensee adopt policies and procedures consistent with applicable state and federal law prior to using an authorized delegate, and provides details stating that a licensee must enter into a contract with an authorized delegate with a list of provisions. Section 9 amends AS06.55.302 concerning unauthorized activities and liability provisions that apply to persons engaging in money transmission on behalf of an unlicensed person. Section 10 amends AS06.55.401 relating to supervision and the department's powers with respect to examination. These sections allow the department to accept examination reports from other states, from the federal government, or from an independent accounting firm. This section requires licensees to pay all costs associated with the examinations, references confidentiality requirements, and eliminates the existing requirement to notify a licensee 45 days prior to an examination. Sections 11 through 14 repeal and reenact sections of AS06.55.403 for consistency with the model law. They require quarterly reports of their authorized delegates. They maintain the existing requirements for immediate reporting knowledge of filing a bankruptcy petition, a proceeding to revoke or suspend a license in another state or country, bond cancellation, and criminal charges. They also allow the department to utilize the NMLS for reporting required by this section. Here, also, executive officer is replaced and repealed, utilizing key individual, a term introduced by the model law, which is a little bit broader than executive officer. Section 15 repeals and reenacts AS06.55.404 regarding acquisition of control of a money transmission licensee, containing procedural and reporting requirements for the acquisition or transfer of control of licensees. It allows exceptions for acquisition of control and contains discretionary provisions for the department for ease and flexibility of administration and the utilization of the national multi-state licensing system. Section 16 through 22 amend language consistency with the model law, increase the record-keeping requirements of licensees from 3 years to 5 years. They remove the requirement that certain money laundering, record keeping, and suspicious transaction reporting requirements be filed with the Attorney General. They include an amendment that provides guidance that is helpful when a licensee or authorized delegate may disclose financial information provided to the licensee or authorized delegate by a customer. Section 23 adds a new subsection F to AS06.55.407, stating what department records may be made public and what information is confidential. Section 24 amends AS06.55 to add new sections to Article 4 from the model law. These provide details when licensees are required to submit an annual audited financial statement at the department within 90 days after the end of the licensee's fiscal year. Sections 25 through 29 revise Article 5 of AS06.55 to rename and broaden its scope from permissible investments to prudential standards. They detail the level of permissible investments required by and provides details on what specific investments can be held by licensees due to risk concerns, and they add language to protect beneficiaries of statutory trusts from actions by creditors of licensees. Sections 30 through 36 amend language for consistency with the model law regarding suspension and revocation of a license by deleting unnecessary language and inserting new terms such as key individual and the replacement of transmission for services. Section 37 amends AS06.55.605 regarding civil penalties, allowing the department to assess its costs and expenses for investigation. These sections also raise the maximum civil penalty to $10,000. Section 38 and 39 amend language for consistency with the model law, conforming language such as deleting money services and inserting money transmission. Sections 40 and 41 amends subsections of AS06.55.607 to remove citations to statute which was repealed. Section 42 amends AS06.55.702A concerning hearings for consistency with the model law and citation to a statute that's repealed. Section 43 and 44 amend language for consistency with the model law, revising licensing exclusions and renaming the section to exemptions. It adds new exemption types and would allow the department to add additional exemptions if it's in the public interest. Sections 45 through 48 amend language regarding notices and receipts, requiring licensees and authorized delegates to provide customers with notice of how to file a complaint, and allows the department to establish the format and content required in the notices on the licensee's website or mobile application. Sections 49 and 50 provide details on timely transmission, requiring licensees to forward money received for transmission in accordance with the agreement. Not doing so, failure to do so, violates would be a violation of state or federal law. Sections 51 and 52 amend language for consistency and state the department shall establish fee levels, including an annual renewal fee based on a licensee's total volume of money transmission in the state. Sections 50 through 61 amend definitions. Changes include the incorporation of the word incorporation of AS 0655 to protect Alaska consumers and ensure revisions are made to align the language of the Act with the model law. Section 62 amends AS 06.55.995 to change the short title of this chapter to the Alaska Uniform Money Transmission Modernization Act. Section 63 amends AS 12.62.400B to read that an applicant under this section may submit fingerprints to the registry. Section 64 repeals several sections in AS 06.55, including the sections on prudential standards. All statutes in Article 2 regarding currency exchange licensees are repealed, and containing two more sections that contain definitions that are no longer necessary. Section 65 through 67 amends by adding a new section for indirect rule amendment and transitional provisions, amending uncodified law to avoid interference with existing contracts. Section 68 inserts transition regulations, giving the department the authority to adopt regulations to implement the Act. Section 69 adds a new section, conditional effect, to allow adoption of transitional regulations by the department. Section 70 provides for an immediate effective date, and Section 71 provides for an effective date for the rest of the bill for July 1st, 2026. And that concludes the sectional narrative.
Thank you very much, Mr. Anderson. There's a lot going on in this bill, I see. I want to recognize that we have Representative Johnson and also Representative Jimmy here as well, and would like to go right into just the single invited testifier that we have and then the single fiscal notes. And looks like we have just one person on for invited test or public testimony so far. So let's go to Rob Schmidt, Director of the Division of Banking and Securities. If you could put yourself on the record and give us your invited testimony.
Hello, my name is Robert Schmidt. I'm the Director of the Alaska Division of Banking and Securities. I'm going to discuss what money transmission is in a more narrative format that is hopefully more easily understood than in a sectional analysis. And I'm going to talk about the fiscal note of this bill. So, House Bill 99 is a generational update to Alaska's financial services laws to accommodate new technologies, to attract innovative businesses to Alaska, protect Alaska consumers, and harmonize Alaska law with that of 30 other states. Originally, money transmission was going into a business like Western Union or MoneyGram, giving them cash to send to a family member, and the business would send a telegram to a local office instructing that office to deliver the money. In the 1980s, stored value cards were introduced. You will see these at, for example, a Fred Meyer, where you can buy a card label, again, for example, Visa, and you pay a cashier at Fred Meyer the amount of money to load onto the card. Stored value cards are also money transmission. Key and important, Alaska's current law is the Uniform Money Services Act. This act was drafted in 2004. It was adopted by the legislature in 2007 and took effect in 2008. In the 21 years since the Uniform Act we have as our law was written, there have been two key developments in money transmission. In 2008, the first beta version of the PayPal app was introduced for the BlackBerry. Now smartphones are nearly universal. Every smartphone has either Apple Pay or Google Pay embedded in it. Both of these companies are among the largest money transmitters sending and receiving Alaskans money. The second major development was in 2007 when a person using the pseudonym Satoshi Nakamoto theorized virtual currency, now commonly called cryptocurrency. This is a representation of value that, unlike normal money, would exist only on digital ledgers and would not be backed or issued by any government or central bank. Mobile payment applications and cryptocurrency now represent the majority of what money transmission is in Alaska. That is to say, these technologies did not exist when our current law was written. House Bill 99 is a generational update to modernize Alaska's money transmission laws to address these technological innovations. House Bill 99 is based on the Money Transmission Modernization Act, which was written by the Conference of State Bank Supervisors with the money transmission industry. You will see there are numerous letters of support from money transmission trade groups and the Alaska Bankers Association. Over $6.3 billion was sent in money transmission to, from, or within Alaska in 2024 by 173 licensed money transmitters. On average, Alaskans use money transmission more than 50 times a minute, 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. Most of that is in the form of mobile payment applications. What does House Bill 99 do? It harmonizes Alaska law with the 30 states that, to date, have adopted the Money Transmission Modernization Act. It creates a single set of rules for licensing, examination, and supervision. Because Alaska still uses the antiquated Uniform Act, Alaska is increasingly becoming a round peg in a nation of square holes. Having similar laws as other states keeps Alaska open for business and reduces burden on industry and the regulator. This bill allows full utilization of the on-wide, nationwide multi-state licensing system, NMLS. One example of efficiencies from fully using NMLS will be saving hundreds of hours of staff time on manual background checks. These will become automated under HB 99. The bill will improve consumer protection. As one example, in 2022, during the crypto winter, when FTX, Voyager, and Celsius all failed, Alaskans lost or had frozen millions of dollars of current cryptocurrency because the user agreement for these companies provided that users' cryptocurrency was, in the event of an insolvency, an asset of the company and not the customer. This bill eliminates the ability of cryptocurrency exchanges to claim customer assets as an asset of the business in a bankruptcy. House Bill 99 contains a fiscal note. The committee should know that, first, all funds in the fiscal note are DGF funds. Our division's receipts pay for our operations. The committee should also be aware that the Division of Banking and Securities has a budget of $4.8 million and in fiscal year 24 had receipts of $22.5 million. Last year, the Division of Banking and Securities made a nearly $18 million contribution to the general fund, and that amount will continue to grow. DBS receipts have increased every year for the last 8 years, and receipts have increased more than 30% over the last decade. However, our money transmission program area, as it exists now, does not generate sufficient revenue to cover the cost of supervision. The reason for this is under the current Uniform Act, every licensee pays the same $3,000 renewal fee, whether they transmit $0 in Alaska or over $1 billion. Alaska currently has $2 billion plus money transmitters, and the top 10 money transmitters range from hundreds of millions of dollars to the high tens of millions of dollars transmitted to, from, and within Alaska. Yet all of these companies pay the same $3,000 as our 30 money transmitters who transmit $0 to, from, or within Alaska. House Bill 99 allows the state to adopt fee tiers based on the total amount of money transmitted to, from, or within the state. The states that have adopted the Money Transmission Modernization Act have set tiers where there is a base fee and then they apply a formula based on the business's total volume of money transmitted to, from, or within that state. Current revenue under existing law for money transmission is about $300,000. If HB 99 becomes law and Alaska utilizes, as one example, Texas's tiered fee model, that revenue will increase to almost $1 million. That is to say, if House Bill 99 becomes law, there will be significant additional revenues that will exceed the fiscal impact of the bill. Please note, there will be no additional cost to Alaska's consumers. PayPal, Venmo, Cash App, Apple Pay, Google Pay, Robinhood, and Coinbase, to name but a few, do not charge customers any more or less based on where they live. Stated another way, Alaskans pay no more than, for example, a Texan, despite having vastly lower fees on the business. The tiered fee model will be designed to cover the cost to regulate the money transmission industry in Alaska, and it will be the right fit for small businesses and not a barrier to entry. Finally, I would like to mention the recent opposition submitted by ADP Payroll Services. ADP was formerly licensed in Alaska as a money transmitter. It is no longer licensed as a money transmitter in Alaska. Rather, it operates under a trust company license issued by the federal government. ADP asserts that payroll processors should have to register as money transmitters. This issue was raised when the Money Transmission Modernization Act was first introduced as a governor's bill in 2022. That bill received opposition from the Independent Payroll Processors Association. That organization argued that most payroll processors in Alaska were small, mom-and-pop local shops with few employees, if not a sole proprietorship. The division researched the issue and determined that there were 100 or more local payroll processors. Including those businesses as money transmitters would impose on these small local businesses the burden of annual license renewal fees, background checks, quarterly reporting, and notably having liquid cash assets, cash in the bank, equal to the amount of their money transmission obligations. The division also noted that it had never received a complaint about payroll processors and could find no history of criminality involving an Alaska payroll processor. The division also noted that payroll processors' work is scrutinized by the employees being paid and by the employer who has payroll obligations, regardless of who gives the employee their wages. The division also noted indirect supervision by the IRS by virtue of payroll processors filing and submitting W-2s, 1099s, 941s, and other tax documentation. The division has also determined that of the 30 states that have adopted the Modernization Act, 14 have excluded payroll processors and 9 states' law is silent on payroll processors. Based on all the foregoing, in 2022, the division recommended exempting payroll processors from the scope of the Money Transmission Modernization Act. 3 years have gone by since that effort, and the bill has been introduced without including payroll processors 2 more times. In those 3 years, utilization of mobile payment applications and cryptocurrency continues to increase, and the existing law is becoming more of a relic as other states adopt the new law. The Division of Banking and Securities continues to recommend that payroll processors be exempted from HB 99. Thank you very much for your time and attention, and I and senior staff are available for any questions you may have.
Thank you, Mr. Schmidt. Were you also going to speak to the fiscal note? You had referenced it, but just wanted to kind of do an official review of it. Or was somebody else going to speak to that? Uh, Mr. Schmidt, maybe what we'll do is we'll have Mr. Anderson, if you could come up and just walk us through the fiscal note, put yourself on the record, and note the control code.
Thank you. For the record, Brody Anderson, staff to Representative Neil Foster. Before the committee today, you have a fiscal note for HB 99 OMB component number 2808, control code TBITW. The fiscal note is broken down into the first page, which shows the transactions or the appropriations for FY26. There is a $15,000 service fee starting for the Department of Law's regulation review for FY26. Moving over to FY27, the fiscal note reflects that there will be a $432,500 increase in personal services for three positions. There will be a $12,000 increase in travel for out-of-state travel for training for those three individuals. A $75,000services for those statewide and allocated core services for those three positions. Then a $36,000 commodity line for one-time equipment costs and setup. Going into FY28, they will bring on another. They'll bring on another two positions for a total of five positions. Their travel will increase to $20,000 for out-of-state training. They will increase $125,000 in services, once again for statewide allocated core services that those five employees will be doing, and then also then commodities will drop down to $20,000 for a stand-up cost, for one-time setup cost for those two employees and moving forward. So, and all of that comes to, for general fund spend in FY26, there'll be $15,000 spent. Then moving into FY27, there will be the additional $555,500. That is just the cost for the three employees, and then in FY26, the full cost of this new program or this new section would be $898,300. Mr. Chairman, that summarizes the fiscal note in front of you, and I know that Hannah Onish is also available. They're the operations manager for banking and securities.
Great, thank you. Yeah, we'll come back to Ms. Dawn Hanisch or Mr. Robert Schmidt as being available for questions. But first, I'd like to go over to public testimony. We just have one person online. Folks would like to submit public testimony, they can do so via email as well, and they can submit that to house.finance@akleg.gov. And I'll open public testimony on HB 99. And we have one person online. First, do I have anyone in the room who would like to testify? I don't see anyone. As far as I know, I think it's just one person online. Is that correct? Okay. Ms. Kathy Tomasovsky, calling in from New Jersey. If you could please put yourself on the record, your name and your affiliation, and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. My name is Kathy Tomaszewski. I'm the Executive Director of the Money Service Business Association. We are very grateful to have the opportunity to speak today in support of a House Bill 99. The MSBA is one of the largest trade associations that is focused on the non-bank money services industry. Our members include licensed money transmitters, agents, authorized delegates, distributors, payment processors, bill payment companies, mobile payment application providers, money order companies, and similar services. MSBA worked alongside other industry representatives and state regulators to create the Uniform Money Transmission Modernization Act. Best HB 99, as Mr. Schmidt outlined, is key to implementing that law and making it consistent across the states. From industry's perspective, it helps to clarify the rules around licensing and regulations. It gives clarity to our companies, many of which provide most essential financial services. Specifically, the provisions create a national standard for customer protections, clarify and standardize definitions of regulated activity, and streamline the state's ability to license and examine money transmitters through the nationwide multi-state licensing system. All of these efforts ensure that customers are protected and payments companies are regulated in the same manner across all jurisdictions. Overall, that we believe that it will House Bill 99 will not only benefit customers, but ensure a consistent framework of robust protections, and the industry appreciates the greater clarity that it will provide. We appreciate your support and are happy to answer any questions you may have. Thank you for the time.
Thank you very much. I have your spelling of the of your last name just to confirm. Is that T-O-M-A-S-O-F-S-K-Y? Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. Okay. It sounds very similar to one of the members on finance, spelt a little bit differently, but also Tomaszewski. So thank you.
Yes. I found that out, I have to say, when I called in and I said, I don't really come across many Tomaszewskis, so that was kind of interesting to me there.
Yes, yes. Well, thank you. Before we go to questions for the sponsor or any of the division personnel, do we have any questions for our public testifier? I realize she's 4 hours later, so it's 6:15 at night there. We've got questions. Representative Stapp and then Galvin. Representative Stapp.
Yeah, there is a lot in this building. Co-Chair Foster, through the chair, to Ms. Tomaszewski. Never thought I'd say that to a public testifier rather than my colleague here to my left. I don't know if you can help on the regulatory side of this or on the payroll processor side, so I do have some questions here. So I guess we'll start with the what can you help me on? Can you help me on the regulatory license sign or the payroll processing sign or the monetary side? We'll start there through the chair.
Ms. Tomaszewski?
So I would say that I may be able to help you on all three depending on the question and the level of detail that you are looking for.
Okay, so thank you. Follow-up, Ms. Co-Chair?
Representative Staff.
Okay, through the chair to Ms. Tomaszewski. All right, so we are changing records compliance from 3 years to 5 years. What is the purpose of that, through the chair?
Ms. Tomaszewski.
So as I noted in my testimony, there were several state regulators as well as industry in that. And in coming to compromise across the state, some states had longer retention records, and we went with that perspective in order to bring people in that wanted to retain those longer.
Fault, Mr. Co-Chair?
Representative Staff.
So is that the industry standard nationwide? And do you know how that conforms to our own laws already? I want to say, like, we might have a 7-year provision, but I can't remember off the top of my head in terms of auditing and stuff like that, through the chair.
Ms. Tomaszewski.
Mr. Schmidt would probably be able to, express this current retention there. I don't recall myself if there was a 7-year retention in the states.
Follow-up, Mr. Co-Chair.
Representative Scott.
Okay, so let's talk about payroll processors here. So I'll give you a very Alaskan example. Let's say I have a bunch of processing seafood plants, and I bring people from out of the country to staff them, and I want to remit their payments for whatever reason in, Ethereum back to their countries of origin, right? And this is how I process payments to them. Maybe it's a bit of a stretch that you'd be that technical in a fish plant in Akatan, but I'm curious what the point of exempting payroll processors to that, if I know that I can remit their payroll in cryptocurrency, through the chair.
Ms. Tomaszewski.
So that one is a little bit more technical for me, and I wouldn't feel comfortable giving you an answer on the phone, but I will, look at that and provide you with a response in writing. For my understanding, you're concerned that payroll processors are exempt, yet you may want to have to remit payments in cryptocurrency, and you want to know how that will work.
Representative.
Yeah, follow up, Mr. Kutcher. So I'll get even more crazy with the example. Let's say I bring a bunch of people in from North Korea, and I employ them, and I pay them in cryptocurrency. Right, I know that seems a little far-fetched, but how would that work? I guess to me, I can think of a lot of reasons why a payroll processor might ultimately pay people in virtual currency as opposed to dollars, especially if they're coming from other countries that might be subject to sanction, i.e. Russia, Iran, that type of stuff. So why would I exempt a payroll processor from these regulatory things in the event that they pay people in
cryptocurrency? Ms.
Tomaszewski. Sure.
So payroll processing is exempted from the licensing and the mainstream regulations of money transmission. When you begin to add in other criteria, such as working with unsanctioned countries and transmitting virtual currency, I think that there may be other regulations that sort of supersede a simple payroll processor exemption.
I think Representative Stepp earlier, I think you might have had comments. Representative Fields.
I was just going to suggest, Mr. Chairman, that Rob Schmidt could talk to the payroll processors and basically in the discussions in the previous committee through the chair, I think the interest was providing a level playing field for both small and large payroll processors and not unwittingly making it harder for our smaller payroll processors to operate when they do pretty traditional payroll processing.
Representative Stout.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. So I'm going to move on from that. I hate to, it's just a really big bill, so I hate to ask a bunch of questions, but there's a lot going on here. Follow-up, Mr. Kutcher.
Representative Stout.
So on the NMLS side, I'm familiar with that because I have an insurance license. So explain to me, what are we doing as terms of fee structure? I know the last testifier talked about a tier fee structure in regs. What are we doing for domestic versus non-domestic processors? Are we charging a different fee out-of-state licensing as opposed to in-state?
Ms. Tomaszewski?
You probably wouldn't know. Probably another person.
I don't know the fee structure for NMLS. You'd have to ask Mr. Schmidt that.
Yeah, through the chair, Mr. Schmidt. Sorry about that.
And I'm wondering if maybe we could hold off our questions for the division. We'll get all our questions out from Ms. Tomaszewski for now, since she's into the evening over there right now. Do you have any other questions for her?
Just last one through the chair. Hopefully, Ms. Schmidt, you probably know this one. What license are they getting? Like if they're going to register as a, let's say, cryptocurrency person, is this like a FEC license, Commission Exchange? Like what licensing are these people actually going to be applying for through the chair?
Ms. Tomaszewski?
They're applying for a money transmission license. The company, it's a company level license, and they are applying for a license to transmit funds and to prove that the funds are safeguarded. They have a one-to-one relationship. We talked about the prudential standards, so that should the company go bankrupt or under, the consumer's funds would be protected, and there's also surety bonding requirements that protect the consumer's funds, not an individual license.
In follow-up to that, Mr. Kutcher, and then follow-up. I'm done.
Okay.
Do the employees of the company that has the money transition license, do they also have to have licenses to do these transactions on behalf of the company through the chair?
So unlike a mortgage company where the mortgage originators, the individuals, have licenses, the money transmission license is associated with the company. There are situations where a company has agents doing business for them. Think if you're in a Walmart and you want to transmit money, you can use Western Union in a Walmart, right? So Walmart is an agent there of Western Union in a way. So, and Walmart would have to have a license as well, but it's at the company level.
Okay. Okay. Questions for Ms. Tomaszewski. I've got Representative Galvin, Representative Allard. Representative Galvin.
Thank you, through Co-Chair Foster. Ms. Tomaszewski, my question is, I understand that there are 30 states so far who have joined in this model law, I'm wondering if you could share, I just found it interesting that some of the states with large population urban centers did not adopt the model law. If you could share any context for that, and the ones that I have in mind are Seattle, Portland, Miami, Philly, New York City, and Charlotte.
So California was part of the group that adopted, that came up with the model law, and they have implemented portions of the model law, not complete there. Part of that has to do with the manner in which their legislative system works and priorities, why there hasn't been a push for full adoption. Florida has operated uniquely in the past. For example, they are the only state that does not use the NMLS system. And CSBS, the Conference of State Banking Supervisors, is working to try to get them to adopt, but it is a slow process. New York is similar to California. They have very strong provisions, in the virtual currency space, for example. They were the first state that had its own BIT license before everyone. So they feel that they have strong protections. So the model law is a secondary priority for them with the other things that they're looking at. And finally, Pennsylvania, I can't speak to.
Okay.
I don't know the reason there.
Thank you.
A lot of times, a lot of times what happens is the model law bill is important. It's a bipartisan bill, but in different states, they have different priorities, and they need to get, the regulators need to work to get someone to sponsor. And this particular bill is, not very fancy or, it doesn't bring in a lot of voters, let's just say, because it's just really an important bill for consumers. So sometimes it's hard for the regulator to get someone to sponsor their bill. And that's why, we're having some slower adoptions in these larger states because they have higher priorities on other bills that are more in the news, I'll say.
Representative Galvin.
Thank you. So what I'm hearing, I think what I heard you say is that some of these states have strong provisions already in place, and so they're a bit slower to the game, perhaps. Is that what I'm hearing? And the ones I also want you to mention, if you would, is Seattle, Washington, and Portland, Oregon, just because they are Northwest states, and I think of that as being important. So that's my next question. I have one more following that.
Ms. Tomaszewski.
So Washington, I know, plans to introduce that, and they were part of, there's a whole multi-state licensing thing, so they had already incorporated some aspects of it. Oregon, I cannot speak to offhand. I apologize.
No, that's fine. And if you have, since we have you on the line and you know so much through the chair, if I may, I wondered if you would share. I see that Nebraska has an initiative along with Alaska, and given that they both have bills in progress, are they pretty much identical? Are we lining up with the model law, or is there some places where Alaska is not?
So overall, I would say you are lining up with the model law. As was noted, you were already implemented with the uniform law. Mm-hmm. So I will say that you were a little ahead of the game, because many of the provisions that we added and, you know, changed in the model law, the uniform law was the basis for it. So if a state was not operating with the uniform law, and there were many less states that implemented that years ago, then a lot of them did a full repeal and replace of the law, as opposed to amending specific sections. We do anticipate Nebraska to sign this year. Also, Mississippi signed. Colorado is signed by the governor, and Virginia signed. This year, I will say, we had less states sign because many states were involved in legislative changes with the elections from last year. So it was hard to, you know, if there was a new person, to be able to explain the values of the bill. So we do expect next year to have, you know, much stronger numbers than we did this particular year.
And I do have one more, if I may. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Co-Chair Foster, through the chair. Ms. Tomaszewski, so what we are doing, regardless, in Alaska, regardless that you've already heard about the transmission fees, the $3,000, regardless of the volume and the extent of the transmission, the level of transmission, I should say, of dollars, if you will, is that pretty standard? I'm thinking about how we will be moving to a tier, and it sounds like the tiers we don't really have explained in the bill itself exactly, because we're asking our department to take care of that. So if you could just share with us what other states are doing around that, the comparing moving from a 3,000 to a tiered system, is that the norm? And would you give us more context around that?
On that particular point, I cannot.
Okay.
I will look up that information and get that to you, but I can't speak to that.
Okay. So if I may, Co-Chair Foster, so the pieces that you are familiar with and part of is how the transmission takes place and what are the rules and laws around that, or the guardrails, if you will. It's not, you are not familiar with how states charge entities. Is that what I'm hearing?
That's correct.
Okay. Thank you. That's all I have.
Representative Ellard.
Co-Chair, this is probably directed to you. Can you tell me what the testifier's expertise is before I go to her, or later hold questions, go back to the director?
She's the executive director of Money Services Business Association, and she is in New Jersey. And maybe Ms. Tomaszewski, I don't know if you'd like her to maybe address that a little more.
All right, so she's for the bill.
Correct.
I'll pass.
I believe. I just probably shouldn't say that.
Well, maybe I can ask her a couple questions, if that's okay.
Representative Ellard.
I am for the week.
Okay.
Yes, go ahead, Representative Ellard.
Okay. So a couple of my concerns are the consumer protection, anti-money laundering, terrorism, regulation burden, high risk of penalties, and size versus costs. So how do you explain those where other states, and crypto is an issue, and the cost of compliance. So how do you, so isn't that part of why some of these states, especially with the crypto, don't want to be involved with this?
Ms. Tomaszewski.
let me make sure I rephrase the question so I understand. So you are you indicated that because of the anti-money laundering requirements that the crypto companies don't want to be involved with the money transmission licensing the states. Is that accurate?
I'm just going to make a... No, I think it's more that people don't want to be involved with it because it can happen that the system is easily to be broken into with the anti-money laundering and terrorism. There's not actually a strong consumer protection, the regulation burden, but there's a high risk of penalties as well to the crypto industry and also the cost of compliance. But it sounds like there's some security issues with enhanced reporting and record keeping and increased data collection. Is that accurate?
I don't believe so. Crypto companies right now are licensed at the state level. Those companies that want to demonstrate in good faith that they're protecting their consumers and also abiding by anti-money laundering. Those laws, your AML program for crypto companies as well as banks, as well as money transmitter companies, those high-level programs are set by FinCEN, and as a registered money service business, which the crypto companies as well, you have to have those programs. So in order to do business, you have to do that. The consumer section requires the companies, and it would be the crypto companies and the regular money, to have a hold in reserve the same amount of money that the consumer has in terms of it, of the transmission. So if I'm going to send money, I'm going to send $100, I have to make sure I have that $100 in order to, if something happens along the way, to make that consumer whole. There's different ways in compliance to track that, whether you're crypto, whether you're digital money, whether you're cash. But all of those protections are important. I'm sure they cross different levels depending on what you're where you're doing and your volumes, but most states are regulating crypto, and some are doing it a little bit differently. But does that answer your question?
No. No. But what I'm going to do, Chair, I don't need to. I'm just going to speak to the committee, if I may, just for a brief second,
sure.
Is that a lot of my concerns with this bill is that the anti-money laundering and terrorism can be infiltrated into this type of bill and this program just based on there's security issues involved. And that it would, that's why a lot of the crypto markets don't want to be involved, because you're looking at enhanced reporting, record keeping, increased data collection. And that's part of my concern. So thank you.
Good. Yeah. Can I just say one more thing? I don't see how by licensing crypto that we are increasing anti-money laundering terrorism, and maybe Director Schmidt can speak to that, because I may not be understanding the question clearly. But
Chair, I don't need a response. I've got the information I need. It's a very partisan testimony. Thank you.
Thank you. Do we have any further questions for Ms. Tomaszewski? If not, we'll let her get on with her evening. I don't see any further questions. Ms. Tomaszewski, do you have any parting comments, and we'll let you go there? But did you have anything else you wanted to say?
No, I just would thank you for the time. I will try to follow up with some responses to the question on the payroll processors. I will reach out to Mr. Schmidt and maybe make sure that I understand the question and concerns just noted so that we can appropriately address them. And I do strongly urge you to pass House Bill 99. Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much. I don't see anybody else in the room or anyone online who would like to testify, so I'm going to go ahead and close public testimony on HB 99. And if folks would like to submit written testimony, they can do so by emailing us at house.finance@akleg.gov. So we'll open it up to questions for either the bill sponsor or the Division of Banking, and that could be on the bill or the fiscal note. We've got Representative Tomaszewski, Representative Bynum, Representative Johnson, Representative Tomaszewski.
Yeah, thank you, Co-Chair Foster, through the chair, to the sponsor. You have one fiscal note in this packet, but I'm looking at a second fiscal note that was same component number, just a different date, and the numbers have changed. I don't know if this represent any kind of change in the bill itself. Is one the LNC component or LNC committee substitute? I have one dated from 2/12/2025, component number 2808.
Representative Fields.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. My staff can address the changes in committee and the corresponding changes in the fiscal note.
Mr. Anderson.
Thanks. Through the chair to Representative Tomaszewski. Evan Anderson, staff to Rep. Fields for the record. So the Labor and Commerce Committee in the House made a couple of changes, three changes to be precise, and they did alter the fiscal note slightly, so that's why we did see the new one published. So the original fiscal note was from the 14th of February, and the updated one is from the 5th of May. The first, there is a summary of changes in members' packets. The first change harmonized the proposed money services business civil penalties with the mortgage civil penalties in existing ASO 6. So this is an existing penalty for mortgage lenders. It's at $10,000. And so as committee members were looking through this bill, they identified that change to remove $1,000 and replace it with $10,000. And there's a couple of other changes as well, but primarily the biggest one is the effective date was pushed out, which gave the department a little bit more time to do the transition regulations.
I should probably be using first names. We have two Mr. Andersons up at the Diaz here. So Mr. Brody Anderson, I think you might have something to add, then we'll come back to Representative Tomaszewski. Mr. Brody Anderson.
Thank you. Thank you for the record. Brody Anderson, staff to Representative Neil Foster. Through the chair, representatives. Control code number KTFKG, the fiscal note in question asked by the representative, should be killed and not considered before this committee. The newest fiscal note that was referenced, control code TBITW, replaces the old fiscal note in your packets. So there is only one fiscal note before the committee, which was the one read into record. The other one which should be considered dead.
Okay, Representative Tomaszewski.
Yeah, I just want thank you through the chair. I just wanted to know because I see on the previous fiscal note there was quite a bit of money for FY26, and in the new fiscal note we only have 15,000. So it goes from 570,000 in 2026 to 15,000 in 2026. So I don't know, is the date pushed back so it's not not being used, or the date is pushed back so it's not in 2026, it's going to start in 2027. Is that the idea?
Mr. Brody Anderson?
Through the chair, that is correct, Representative, because the effective date was pushed back a year. The only cost for FY26 will be the cost of the regulation review process. So that's the $15,000 now found in FY26. Once the regulations are done and they enact this bill in full force, then in FY27 moving forward, you'll see those added transactions.
Thank you.
Okay. We've got Representative Bynum, Johnson, and Galvin. Representative Bynum.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster, through the chair. I was going through the fiscal note, one control code, TBITW. And in here we indicate, and some of the testimony that was given talks a lot about creating efficiencies in the fiscal notice. Says it will reduce regulatory burden, create uniformity across states, which is a good thing. We like to see that, especially for the licensing and the examination processes. This says that it'll allow the department to, or the division to, coordinate more efficiently and effectively. And then we get in here and we talk about adding positions. So I'm just was hoping to get a little more detail on if we're creating a system that's going to be more efficient, getting rid of archaic systems that require lots of labor, and we're putting in this new system that will be more efficient and more streamlined. Just hoping to get a little more insight onto the added positions in the fiscal note here.
Through the chair. Thank you, Ms. Chair Foster. Through the chair to Representative Bynum. The growth, there's been a lot of growth in money transmission, and we're behind on that. So, yes, the system is more efficient, and if we have adequate staff, we will then capture additional revenue, as Mr. Schmidt noted. Our statutes are woefully out of date right now with respect to where technology is, and I would defer to Mr. Schmidt for more detail on that. And I would note that it's not just a money issue when our statutes are this out of date. There might be money laundering. There might be issues of fraud that the department is unable to address because the statutes are out of date.
Mr. Schmidt? Okay. If you could put yourself on the record, Mr. Schmidt.
Yes, through the chair. There, our examinations team for non-bank institutions, which would be mortgage lenders, money transmitters, and others, we have four people responsible for examining 600 institutions. This bill adds positions so that we can actually get to and regulate and oversee many of these. For example, in the mortgage industry, we typically only examine 2% of licensed mortgage lenders per year. It is not uncommon for a mortgage lender to go through their entire career and never be subject to examination. As another point of reference, in 2020, all of money transmission, stored value cards, mobile payment applications, crypto, all of it was $2.8 million. In 4 years, that number has more than doubled. The number of money transmission licensees has gone from about 90 to 190 5 years ago to 173 this last year. So, yes, we are asking for the bill absolutely increases efficiencies, but the additional positions are needed to simply reflect the growth in the industry.
Thank you. And a follow-up?
Representative Bynum.
So Section 53 provided in the bill talks about the department being able to establish fees under the chapter to approximately equal the department's actual total regulatory cost. Do we anticipate that the approximate fees being set, that we're using the word approximate there because obviously we won't know 100%, but do we anticipate that the department will raise the fees necessary to cover all of these costs associated with the implementation of the program, and or will there be any delay in the ability to do that?
Mr.
Schmidt. Through the chair, yes. We will be establishing fees that approximately cover the cost of administration. With the delayed enactment, we should be able to have those regulations in place for the renewal season after this bill takes effect.
Thank you.
Okay, next up I have Representative Johnson and Galvin. Representative Johnson. Owen Stapp. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a series of questions. Some of them are interrelated and some are not. So I guess I'll just start going through some of them, if you will bear with me. I'd start by saying, is this bill affected by HB 113 at all?
Representative Fields.
Through the chair, I believe the answer is no. Mr. Schmidt can confirm.
Mr. Schmidt, any comments?
I am not, through the chair, I am not familiar with HB 113.
Representative Fields, if you could.
So I'm going to do my best. I'm not the lead on 113, but SB, I'll attempt to answer the question.
If I might just kind of change.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you. I'm sorry. If I might just change the way I phrase that and just say how would it be affected by 113 or if.
Through the chair, I don't believe it would be affected. SB 113 is about where commerce takes place and the corresponding taxes, whereas this bill is updating a regulatory structure around money transmission. So they're just separate areas of policy.
Representative Johnson?
If I might dialogue just a little bit, because I have so many different questions. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So obviously, if we're, I'm still trying to wrap my head around how exchange of money might be different than, you know, if Amazon's selling a product, but we're actually selling a transmission in a sense, or would that be, I mean, I'm not expecting you to answer that, but I mean, certainly that needs to be clarified as we go through this process. Is at least it's important to me.
Representative Fields?
I can answer that.
Mr. Chair, if I may.
We'll go to Representative Fields first.
Through the chair, this bill doesn't affect Amazon. That's sales, and this is about money transmission, and that's just kind of why they're separate. So maybe Mr. Schmidt has more to add.
Director Schmidt?
A customer does not pay a tax, a sales tax on a good when they use money transmission. Whether this would impact corporate sales taxes for businesses that operate in Alaska, I simply don't know. I don't know if the money transmitters that operate in Alaska pay sales taxes in other states or income taxes in other states. I know they do not pay sales taxes because they're not selling a good.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So could they potentially pay a sales tax on each transmission as it was sold? I mean, you know.
Through the chair.
Is that possible to do it?
Representative Fields.
Through the chair, I think we could tax money transmission, but that's not what this bill does.
I understand. Thank you.
Okay.
I'm just investigating the possibility if I might continue just to go through my
question. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, thank you. So I have going on, and I'll try to get some of those questions answered. But I would, I guess my next question would be what problem is this bill trying to solve? And I can guess by saying that the attempt is to have an industry bill that standardizes money transmission laws across, banking institutions, various states, and so on. And we have, there's things the federal government can regulate as far as cross-state transfers, obviously, and, transportation and so on, and some that it doesn't. And that's left up to the states, which this is left up to the states. So I'm guessing this is an industry bill that mostly helps the industry by standardization. Is that correct?
Representative Fields?
Through the chair, I think multiple parties have different interests in this bill. I think the reason you see industry testimony is that it is easier for the industry to have a consistent regulatory environment, which the bill provides. That's actually not my motivation in agreeing to carry the bill for the department. My motivation is I think the department has made a good case, including when this was a governor's bill last year, that modernization of these statutes will help fight crime and protect our constituents from fraud. And when you look at money laundering with cryptocurrency, Division of Banking and Securities is part of having a functional rule of law. And then when you look at fraud, particularly targeting elders, you see fraud both through cryptocurrency and other forms of money transmission, as well as what Director Schmidt called these stored value cards. It's actually a pretty common way elders are targeted for fraud. So, you know, when Mr. Schmidt talks about the department just being able to have a regulatory presence, that is going to end up reducing the ability of these fraudsters to target our elders, and where there may be money laundering, it will ensure that DBS has more oversight of it and can work with partner law enforcement agencies to keep Alaskans safe. So my interest is protecting elders and public safety. The industry also benefits because of the level playing field.
Representative Johnson.
All right. Continuing on. So, I mean, obviously everyone would think those are good ideas. I guess my concern is as we move into a more and more digital types of buying, that as we attempt to make sure that cryptocurrency is regulated, that we don't also, you know, and that we don't have the fraud and so on, that we don't unwittingly, because I believe there's still an information gap, and that we're not unwittingly causing Alaska, where I truly believe there's opportunity here. Alaska could be a real leader in how we deal with holding financial instruments and allow for different types of transactions to take place. But standardizing things actually causes us to just be like everyone else. I just want to say that. But so I want to continue to look at that so we're not, you know, causing ourselves not to have opportunities that we might have in this fear our fear of cryptocurrency isn't going to cause us to also take out an opportunity. I guess that then so that's why I always wonder when people say, well, other states are doing it, we better get Alaska on board too. And I think, well, maybe other states have been hidebound by hundreds of years of certain types of regulation, and maybe Alaska has the opportunity to look at things with a little fresher perspective. But my question would be, if there's any opportunity in here, I've kind of made a commitment to myself that when I see a fiscal note come through, I'm either going to try to figure out how it's absolutely going to pay for itself, and not just pay for itself up to a break even or maybe break even, but actually, you know, how can I make sure that, is there another way to capture revenue? If we're really going to deal with the fiscal crisis in Alaska, it's probably going to be a little bit at a time. And, you know, is there a way of capturing additional revenue off of the money transmission market?
Representative Fields.
Through the chair, Representative Johnson, this bill will more than pay for itself by orders of magnitude, both as a result of the updated fee structure and as a result of just adequate staff to run the program. And I think you might have been out of the room when Director Schmidt walked through that, but it is to the tunes of millions of additional dollars net.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm looking at the updated fiscal note, TBITW, and I'm looking at the positions. It looks like there's, and I was thinking about asking the department, but it looks like there's, I guess it's four positions. One that's a range 14 in Juneau. That's a very, that's not a lot of money. I'm really quite curious what the vacancy rate for people that have these types of jobs in Juneau already. I mean, is there extra people out there that are kind of looking around for a range 14 job that would be, available at a range 14 and a range 17, 19, and then there's a range 23 that's located in Anchorage. And then you add on some more that are also located in Anchorage, Range 21, and so on. But it looks pretty. Looks like it's a minimal amount. If we're going to charge fees, I mean, we may as well charge enough fees to make sure that people are paid well enough to do the job and well enough to actually get somebody hired in Juneau, not just, you know, hire somebody at a bare. Not, you know, I would say that I'd question whether that's even a range that someone's going to have a living wage at in Juneau. So anyway, so I would like to encourage people to get paid a little bit better so we can actually fill the vacancies right now. If we're going to charge fees and we're going to do this, we should do it right and not just pretend that, well, I should. We want to make sure we pay people well enough and have the, but also I really, this, I'm just looking at the fiscal note and not the, And not at the bill itself, but it says that it's approximately $500 to $1 million in new revenue. Well, that's not to me, it might be, I guess it's technically new revenue, but I mean, if it's just going to be indexed based on the expenses that you have to pay, I don't know that there's real new, I mean, I guess there's new revenue to the state, but it's certainly not new revenue in any sense that it's actually going to provide any revenue to us, or am I misreading that?
Representative Fields?
Through the chair to represent Johnson, I think I would probably turn to Mr. Schmidt both for elaboration on the positions, what they do, whether they're adequately compensated, and why this bill will generate net additional revenue. And to be clear, I mean, I didn't introduce it to generate revenue. I introduced it because I think modernizing these statutes is important for public safety and law enforcement, but it does have that net additional benefit. And I would also observe that in working with the department for a number of years, they do a really good job retaining staff in division of banking and security. So I think I certainly support paying state employees more, but they do a good job in this division.
Director Schmidt, do you have any comments?
If, through the chair, Representative Johnson, if you could sort of break down into bite-sized chunks your questions, please.
Representative Johnson?
I could possibly do that. Well, I think one thing I had mentioned is just kind of questioning the range 14, range 17 and 19, and the range 23. And I guess I would go to what is your current vacancy rate, and if those levels of pay are high enough to actually break through that kind of lock that we have on not being able to hire enough people and get to really be able to hire the people we're saying we're going to here, or if maybe that needs to be raised.
Okay. I became division director in December of 2021, and we had a 30% vacancy rate. By 2023, we were one of the first divisions in state government to be fully staffed, and later in 2023, the Division of Banking and Securities won the Alaska Journal of Commerce's award for best workplace in Alaska in the small employer division. Out of 27 vacancies, we currently out of 27 positions, we currently have 2 vacancies. This bill provides, and I should speak specifically to our licensing staff in Juneau, which is the positions in Juneau are added. We have not had any change. Our licensing staff has been fully staffed continuously by the same people since I started in December of 2021. The higher stepped staff are financial examiners. These people frequently have college degrees or finance backgrounds. They're the people that actually go on the examinations to examine the safety, soundness, and compliance of these businesses.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So you're saying that your thought is this will that these levels of pay are fine, and you don't think you'll have any concerns about filling those?
I have, in my capacity as director, no opinion on the adequacy of the pay of state employees.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I'm wondering, did you prepare or who provided the pay scale than our fiscal note? Somebody had to think this through, I guess. I don't know exactly who provided that. The finance, I guess, legislative finance, perhaps.
Director Schmidt.
If I may, through the chair, Representative, our operations manager, Dawn Hanisch, who is available on the phone, she prepared the fiscal note, and she can speak if you want to, speak at very granular levels of detail. She would be happy to assist you.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you. No, I guess I don't need that. I just want to remind people that when we look at this, we want to make sure to pay people enough that we kind of try to take care of our vacancy rate. So we're not paying too low. It seems like a low amount. But and I had other questions in there, but mostly I want to make sure that I guess one of the other questions is there any other way to generate revenue with this bill? And I want to make sure that it doesn't cost us anything we do can't cost us more.
Representative Fields.
Through the chair, I think one of the most important provisions in this bill is changing the fees so that the department has the ability to look at volume and value in money transmission. I guess I had not looked at this as a general revenue raiser so much as a regulatory functionality in law enforcement bill. I would defer to Mr. Schmidt about if we were going to look at it as a revenue raiser, what else might we contemplate? I hadn't looked at it from that perspective before.
Director Schmidt, do you have any comments?
Through the chair, Representative Johnson, one of the first and still to this day most frustrating things I learned when I took this job is that a company that moves $1 billion of Alaskans' money pays the same renewal fee as the money transmitter in Nome, Alaska. It made no sense. No private business would price their services in this way. This bill will pay for itself because it gets away from the same $3,000 renewal fee for widely different businesses. This bill, by allowing an appropriate fee based on how much money somebody is moving in Alaska, is much more common sense oriented than where we are at now. Our fee revenue currently is $300,000, roughly. That revenue will increase to $800,000, $1 million or more. We currently lose money on regulating money transmission because of the antiquity of the current statute. Every year that this bill does not pass is more money that the state of Alaska does not earn. And the longer we are operating in the red, regulating money transmission, if and when this bill passes, we will adopt regulations that finally will cover the cost of this program area. Like I mentioned before, I don't know if you were in the room when I mentioned it, the Division of Banking and Securities has a $4.8 million budget. Last year we had receipts of $22.5 million. We generate and contribute to the general fund. Last year it was $17.7 million, and that's up 50% from a decade ago. It's gone up for the last 8 years. Every year we've contributed more to the general fund. But we don't, this program area does not pay for itself. Most of our revenue comes from the security side, where we issue about 150,000 registrations at about $75 a pop. The fees vary, but it's the massive volume of about 150,000 total different registrations on the security side that constitute most of the division's revenue. But the key point is, every year this does not pass is another year we're stuck with the old statute, and we're stuck charging the same $3,000 for everybody that doesn't even cover our cost of operations. The sooner this bill becomes law, the sooner we can change that.
Thank you.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So then I wanted to ask one more question then about payroll processing. Kind of seems like maybe that should be included as well, or is there a reason that that's left out since that's increased so significantly?
Director Schmidt.
Through the chair, after I wrote my prepared written remarks, I've been informed that an amendment is being contemplated that might include payroll processors but might have allow regulatory carve-outs for the small Alaska-based payroll processors. I it is my sense as the regulator that it is an undue burden on the very small shops. You know, the people, you can see their signs up, you know, in my hometown of Anchorage, you drive down Northern Lights and you see signs for bookkeeping and payroll. I'm sure there are folks like that in the Valley. Subjecting them to background checks, the licensing fee, which even at its base will be thousands of dollars, the quarterly reporting requirements, and then significantly, every money transmitter has to have an amount of money in their own bank account, if you will, to cover their money transmission obligations. I am concerned that's a very onerous requirement of the small 1-2-3 person Alaska bookkeeping / payroll services.
Follow-up on that?
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So is there a level that you would say that you should include? I mean, no, maybe a larger, any kind of, and I know this is an off-the-top of your head kind of question, but I mean, I can see what you're saying about maybe small payroll processing companies, but any larger ones? That, I mean, is there any level where you think that it would be appropriate to have those background checks and so on?
Through the chair, yes. I would particularly note that ADP, who brought this issue to the forefront, is a very large nationwide payroll processor. And if you read the financial news, as I do for my job, every month you will hear about the ADP unemployment report that they publish. That is to say, ADP is so big and has so much awareness of the American job market that they publish a leading report on unemployment in the United States. But to get to the point of your question, I don't know where I would draw that line, but I would certainly agree that there is a point where regulation of these entities is not an excessive burden.
All right. Thank you. That's all I have.
Okay. Representative Galvin.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster, through the chair. I have a few little questions that I'm not sure whether you prefer to answer them as the maker or perhaps defer, but I will just check in. I noticed in the packet I'm not seeing others who I might have expected to give their opinion about the bill, the chamber, or small businesses, banks, credit unions, anyone of the sort. If you could comment on that.
Sure.
Representative Fields.
Through the chair, the Alaska Bankers Association does support the bill. The primary affected industry and the invited testifier you heard does represent the main money transmitters.
So. Okay. You mean Mr. Tomaszewski?
Yes.
Was representing.
Through the chair, yes.
Okay, thank you. Through the chair, another question is, I appreciate the comments around protecting elders, especially from fraud and laundering, others from laundering. And I saw that there are fines built within there. Are there any other penalties besides that if they were to go outside of? They lose license? I'm just not familiar.
Yeah, I want to turn to Ms. Rob Schmidt for that, please.
Mr. Schmidt?
Through the chair, Representative Galvin, we find crimes, and when we find crimes, we try to send people to jail. A little more detailed and nuanced answer to your question is Title VI contains blanket criminal provisions for all of the Title VI programs, banking, mortgage lending, etc., including money transmission. And then we also, in our criminal investigations, we routinely rely on theft, particularly first-degree felony theft.
Thank you. And through the chair, I assume that Title VI was strong enough that you didn't feel like modernizing that was pertinent at this given time in this bill.
Through the chair, we did enhance the daily penalties. But in terms of criminal provisions, we feel that we have adequate tools on the penalty side to do the work that we need to do. I would also comment that we have an enforcement section that is currently very busy, and they are investigating frauds and scams ranging from $2,000 involving an elder Alaskan to millions of dollars. And many of these are frequently older Alaskans. It often involves, but not always involves, cryptocurrency. And we are making very significant strides behind the scene that I would love to talk about, but I cannot. But we are out there protecting people every day, every day.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Through the chair, I have another question. This is related to the tiered costs, we couldn't quite ascertain from Ms. Tomaszewski what other states are doing, and so I just wanted to know if you modeled this tiered after the market value. Like, how was that? How did you come to that model of not model law, the model of costs for, instead of the $3,000 set price, to this tiered price? If you could tell me if that was a market choice.
Through the
Representative Fields?
Through the chair, that was a suggestion of the department, because a $3,000 fee makes no sense for a company transmitting $1 billion. And beyond that, Mr. Schmidt could probably elaborate.
And also, let's go to Mr. Evan Anderson.
Thanks. Through the chair, for the record, Evan Anderson, staff to Rep. Fields. I'll just color in a little bit of detail before handing it off to Mr. Schmidt. But the Division of Banking and Securities has shared a draft model plan with us in response to the language contained in this bill. They're envisioning a tiered system ranging from $3,000 to, I believe, about $30,000 for that annual fee. But the language in the bill is flexible, so that as money transmission volumes increase over time, that annual fee could also increase into the future.
Thank you.
Okay. Let's see, Director Schmidt, did you have any comments on that?
Through the chair, the two states that we are particularly looking at are Ohio and Texas. And looking at the formulas that they use, and it's not to say that we will exactly utilize those, but we are using those as a reference point while we determine the total cost of this program area. And then, as is stated in the Act, we will make the fees approximately equal the cost of the program area.
Okay, thank you. We've got about 15 more minutes. We've got two more questions here, and then we'll probably call it a day. I've got Representative Stapp and Allard. Representative Stapp.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Foster. Through the chair to Rep. Fields or staff. I think I didn't hear this in the sectional, so I want to give another shot at this to explain. Section 37 of the bill. Section 37, which is the civil penalties, okay? What is the conditional effect related to that section of this bill, through the chair?
Representative Stapp, or I'm sorry, Fields?
Yes, so we did update that number given the age of the statute, but for the sort of how it will operate or be enforced, Rob Schmidt would be a better person to answer that.
Sorry, Representative Stapp.
Yeah, just follow up. All right, well, I'll try to make it easier. Section 69 of the sectional analysis for the bill, it says, adds a new section, conditional effect to allow adoption of transitional regulations by deed. Through the chair, can you explain to me that section of the bill? Because I read that section of the bill, and there are pretty material things in that section that are kind of important that were left out of the sectional, through the chair.
Mr. Evan Anderson.
Yeah, for the record, Evan Anderson. Thanks, Chair Foster. Through the chair to Representative Stapp. I believe this was a change that we made in-house, Labor and Commerce, since we set the effective date for the bill a year into the future, that we wanted to give the department the ability to promulgate regulations. And if I remember correctly, I believe that was a suggestion from the department.
Yeah, follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
Okay, just so everyone understands, Section 69, if you turn there, it's conditional language that requires us to have a two-thirds vote on this bill to make Sections 37 and Section 65 actually incorporated into law. So Section 37 of this bill, so that if you go to page 65, it says, on line 14, it says, as amended, Section 37 of this Act takes effect only if Section 65 of this Act receives the two-thirds majority of each houses as declared in the Constitution. Right? So my question to you is, if this bill were to pass, Section 37 doesn't receive two-thirds vote, what happens to the bill in terms of the penalties, through the chair?
Representative Fields?
That is going to be a better question through the chair to be answered by Ledge Legal, and happy to talk to Ledge Legal and get back to you about that.
Yeah, follow up, Mr. Co-Chair.
Follow up?
Yeah, could you do on Section 65 as well? So other thing, just for the record, like, that's a pretty key detail about a bill not to kind of mention when you present it, that it's conditional based off a two-thirds vote threshold for key provisions. So I don't know if that's an oversight, but because to me, if you don't, and I'll leave it for there before I go to other aspects in the bill. So just, and like,
can I just jump in?
Representative Fields?
This bill did pass the Senate, I think, unanimously, so I'm happy to follow up, but it also has been broadly supported.
Okay. I'm going to shift gears here a little bit if I could, Mr. Co-Chair, through the
Representative
chair.
Representative
Staff? Yeah, through the chair. So other sections of this bill, I don't quite understand why we are being so prescriptive in some of our definitions. So on page 49, through the chair, either to Rep. Fields or to our gentleman online. On line 2 in section 57 of the bill, we are deleting estates and trusts from our definition and replacing them with partnerships, liabilities, stock corporations, corporate entities. And then we have this line, as identified by the department. So the question would be, why would we delete trusts and estates, through the chair?
Through the chair, I think we're not actually deleting trusts. If you look at, it says corporation, trust, limited liability, company, association. So it replaces an estate, a trust, a partnership with trust, and then lists the others out separately is how it looks to me.
Representative Fields? Sorry, Representative Sapp.
Yeah, I see in brackets through the chair, I see an estate, a trust, a partnership, in brackets, and then it just says a limited liability association joint stock corporation.
Through the chair, look at trust on line 3. So it does retain trust. It's confusing because there's a bracket right before trust and then a bracket right after, but it does retain trust.
Okay. Fault, Mr. Co-Chair?
Representative Stapp.
Section 58, line 11, a United States military installation located in a foreign country. That's a very odd thing for me to insert into state statute, so I'll give you an own personal example. So to me, I read that as a COB in Iraq, right? So I guess probably not the sponsor, but the banking folks. How on earth could we as a state codify something in our statute that allows us jurisdiction in a foreign country that we're occupying for a military installation, through the chair?
Representative Fields?
I'll turn to Rob Schmidt about that one. Thank you.
Director Schmidt?
Regarding the contours of these definitions, I'm going to refer to my chief of examinations, Tracy Reno.
Ms. Reno, if you could put yourself on the record. Yes, we can hear you. Maybe
through the chair.
Go ahead.
This is Tracy Reno. I'm the Chief of Examinations for the Division of Banking and Securities. Mm-hmm. We have been working with the Conference of State Bank Supervisors, other states. Obviously, it's a model law. And so the changes that are made mostly throughout this bill are the Modernization Act, and so trying to make sure that all the states are treating it the same way when we have to do examinations, when we have to do enforcement. And so we're trying to make sure that the language is the same across the way. So if we do a multi-state enforcement action against a big national company, we all have the same language in our laws for that enforcement.
That's a fault, Mr. Co-Chair.
Representative Staff?
So I'm going to read it for you because it makes no sense to me. It says state in parentheses on page 49 means a state of the United States, the District of Columbia, Puerto Rico, the United States, Virgin Islands, a U.S. military installation that is located in a foreign country or a territory in sovereign possession of the jurisdiction of the United States. So everything makes perfect sense to me. You have U.S. states, you have U.S. territories, you got Puerto Rico, Washington, D.C., we have military bases. It just seems really weird to say a U.S. military installation that is located in a foreign country. So we have a base in Syria. Does that mean we are going to subject our laws to the country of Syria, even though they're a separate country? Like, how does that work through the chair?
Ms. Reno?
Through the chair, that's a great question, Representative, and what I can do is get back with the drafters of the model law and get an answer for you and respond back to that.
Okay. Mr. Chairman.
Representative Fields.
And I can add to that. So in the statutes now, 0655995, under the banks and financial institutions, state means a state of the United States, District of Columbia, Puerto Rico, Virgin Islands, or a territory or insular possession subject to the jurisdiction of the United States. So, you know, perhaps this is referencing the territory or insular possession subject to the jurisdiction, which probably would be a military base. But I don't know why the banking and security section has that language.
Representative Stapp.
But that's existing statute.
Yeah, I think, Co-Chair, I think Rep. Fields. Yeah, no, I read the existing statute, too. The only thing that's changing here is inserting that line that says a U.S. military installation that is located in a foreign country. Very strange thing to add to my statute, but I'm going to go to my last question here.
Could I say one more thing?
Representative Fields?
So just through the chair, I mean, one thing I think about is part of this is protecting Alaskans and the earlier reference of Mr. Schmidt about crypto and retaining value. I mean, I think there's some benefit in protecting, say, an Alaskan who is stationed overseas. So perhaps that's why, but definitely look forward to learning more from Ledge Legal.
Yeah, last follow-up here. In the night, that's all I got on the regulatory side. Page 49 again through the chair, and maybe this is online again. Section B, line 22, 49, says, does not mean a payment institution or a closed-loop stored value or a stored value not sold to the public but issued and distributed as part of loyalty rewards promotional program. I read that, and I thought, gold and silver bill. Are we referencing gold as a closed-loop stored value, or what does that actually mean?
Through the chair, I think what that is referencing is, you know, you go to a grocery store and you earn these, quote, points, and you can use them for value to, you know, you save $2 3 months later, and that does not constitute money transmission. And that's like a very traditional kind of, you know, loyalty program by a store.
Somebody define closed loop stored value for me, and then I'm done.
Representative Fields.
Through the chair, closed loop would mean that's not being sold on the marketplace. It is at IGA.
Sounds like the gold in my basement. Thanks.
Okay. Next up, Representative Ballard.
Yeah. Thank you, Co-Chair. So I'm concerned because it kind of feels like this is an industry bill, and it's being pushed by the industry, and they're using government to do it. And I'm also concerned in regards to crypto, and I don't know if anybody can speak on it, because the security in this bill, it's not there. What I mean by that is that there's a lot of anti-money laundering groups and terrorism groups that are, well, to prevent terrorism, are saying that this opens the lack of security for individuals' information to be exposed. So why we sit here and say we're trying to protect the elders, this actually has so much information about individuals that the security level of it is not favorable. Could you speak to that a little bit, Representative Fields, and perhaps also speak about how this will impact crypto? Because I know the crypto industry is not on board with these.
Representative Fields.
If you can hit those 2 points, I know we might not have enough time.
Sure.
Representative Fields.
Thank you, Chair Foster. Through the chair, I actually didn't see this as an industry bill. I thought the department staff who conduct enforcement oversight made a very compelling case that we should update the statute so they could do their job, and that I think they made a good case, and that's why I introduced the bill. I haven't seen communication from the crypto industry, which is, it is a very politically astute industry, but I haven't seen communication criticizing the bill, and I'm sure they're aware of it, and I would defer to Director Schmidt about privacy and how this bill does enhance Alaskans' security in the money transmission market.
Director Schmidt.
Through the chair, thank you for the question. If you want to encourage the financing of terrorism or the laundering of money or other inappropriate uses of the money transmission industry, the best way to do that is to not regulate it. If you want to prevent scams, frauds, money laundering, the financing of terrorism, you allow regulators, you allow bank examiners to go in, financial examiners to go in and examine the books, records, policies, procedures, actually audit data on compliance with the Bank Secrecy Act. You audit their compliance with filing suspicious activity reports with the Department of Treasury's Financial Crimes Enforcement Network. This bill modernizes and improves those abilities. Also, to the comment that this is an industry bill, I apologize for that sense, but it is inaccurate. We worked closely with the Conference of State Bank Supervisors in bringing this bill forward. We've had CSBS staff testify about this bill. We routinely rely on the expertise of other state regulators in assisting us with this project. For example, my equivalent division in New York State has over 1,000 employees, and I have 27. This bill has been advanced and passed in the states as diverse as Massachusetts and Texas, Illinois, and Indiana. There is no political through line in the states that have adopted this. I would also comment on the states that have not adopted this. When you are talking about the very largest urban centers in America, frequently they just adopt their own laws because they have the resources to do that. In particular, New York State, routinely, we don't need or want anybody to draft a model law for us because we will draft our own law that reflects our own New York priorities. I could not, with my staff of 27, draft an equivalent bill to this. So this is very much not an industry bill. Let me assure you that as part of my job, I am right now working to get people put in jail for being crooks, for doing bad things to Alaskans. I am not here to coddle anybody. Uniformity certainly helps business, but that is not where this is going. If you want to be a bad actor in the crypto space, step number one is don't be licensed in the United States. The companies that seek out and receive licenses from American states have the best compliance. They are the most responsive. How do I know this? Because I'm trying to get back scammed Alaskans' money from cryptocurrency exchanges outside of the United States, and it ain't easy. But dealing with the cryptocurrency exchanges that are licensed in the United States, it is an entirely different story. So no, this is not an industry bill. This is a bill that will protect consumers. It will harmonize regulation. Right now, I send my examination team out to, for example, PayPal, one of the very largest money transmitters there is. And they are there on site for weeks examining and auditing records. And yet they're using the toolkit from 2004
not the modern toolkit that most of the other people there are using. And that benefits no Alaskans. Thank you.
Representative Ballard.
Thank you. One, I don't appreciate being mansplained to, but I also wanted to say the reason some of the crypto industry or members of it are very upset because they're saying this particular bill doesn't have enough security in it. So none of my questions were answered. Thank you. I have no further comment.
Representative Fields.
I did just also want to mention for the committee, the Alaska Public Interest Research Group and the Consumer Federation of America reviewed the bill, and they have a very modest amendment suggestion that we'll work with members on. But, yeah, we didn't just take industry's word for it and, frankly, didn't just take the department's word for it. We did have national consumer protection experts review the bill.
Last question, Representative Josephson.
Well, it's actually more of a comment. I try to engage where I can be helpful. And Representative Stapp asked about Section 37. It's referred to in Section 69. But essentially, our Constitution says if we're going to change court administration rules, because that's sort of their turf, we can do it with two-thirds votes of both chambers. And so what would happen if we failed that vote on the floor is I think we could still increase the fine to 10,000 from 1,000 per day. But these are tough attorney's fees and costs that you wouldn't normally see ever in a regular criminal case. So in a regular criminal case, a defendant wouldn't be charged for having been convicted. It might be fined, of course, but no prosecutor's fees would come to him or her. But in this one, there's an extra hammer along with the $10,000 a day. And if we didn't pass by two-thirds in each chamber, then the fees and the fees and costs wouldn't be as tough, essentially. But the bill would survive.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, any closing comments, Representative Fields?
Thank you for the time to discuss this bill, and I really appreciate all the work that the department staff have done to bring it forward and educate multiple committees over now for almost 4 years, I think.
Great. Well, thank you very much. So with that, we're going to go ahead and set this bill aside, HB 99. Our next scheduled meeting is tomorrow. That's Wednesday, May 7th at 9 a.m. And so with that, we will be adjourned at 3:33 p.m. Thank you.